Hi, welcome everyone. Thanks very much for coming along to this session. My name's Andy Wigley. I work in our DX group, developer experience, and my job is to work with developers to help them create cool stuff with Windows and Azure. And I work from the UK, although my team is in Redmond, and I've been in Microsoft for quite some time. And with me, I've got...
Hi, my name's Ken Rosen. For about 20 years, up until about 3 weeks ago, I worked in the DX organization at Microsoft. Just moved over to Infragistics, whom I think many of you know as a developer productivity company that brings great controls and tools to life. So the name on the badge has changed, the company name, but the mission's still the same. Microsoft and Infragistics still work together to help developers create great experiences on top of the Windows platform. And that's what we're going to talk about today, some of the tools, techniques, controls, considerations that you can use to make great user experiences.
Great. Now, a lot of this talk, just to set this right, as Ken said, we're going to talk about some tools and techniques. So there's some coding stuff. I'm really primarily a developer, but it's beholden to all of us to create really great user experiences, and that's a combination of a number of things. And it's a combination of sort of design, and it's also about the functionality, and it's making your app respond well to the situations where your users use it. So if you want to sort of sum up exactly what a good user experience is, well, you want to have an app that's going to, if it's a UWP app, it could be running on a wide range of different screen sizes, or indeed the user could resize the window when it's running on a desktop PC. So you need to have an app that's going to adapt well to those different screen sizes and displays. You want to make sure that obviously the layout is clean and effective. You know, we don't like real busy screens. We want to have it nicely laid out and a pleasure to look at and a pleasure to interact with. And the usage needs to be intuitive. So this is all the function of good design of your application and how your users, thinking about how your users are going to interact with it. And we also need to think about, with UWP apps, and the combination of user input methods. So a UWP app can run on a desktop with a keyboard and mouse. It could run on a phone or a tablet where it's touch. Or it could run on a HoloLens, which is like this crazy sort of 3D world, and it's kind of there in front of your vision. So we've got all of these different ways, and your app could run on all of those. So depending on your particular target scenario, of course. But you need to make sure that wherever and however your user uses that app, it's going to adapt accordingly to make sure that they have a great user experience regardless of the situation and the device where they end up encountering it. And the other factor, I think, with a great user experience is people want to get that feeling that somebody sweated the details and have put some effort into making this a nice, smooth, good animations, a pleasant, beautiful experience. And we have great tools within the UWP API set for creating beautiful animations, some new stuff that's come out in the most recent update, the anniversary update, which was released around, six, 7 weeks ago. There's some great new APIs in there for doing beautiful animations that you can do that's really not too hard. You don't have to be a complete, graphical whiz kid to produce these great experiences. So we're going to touch a little bit on some of that stuff as well. So if you want to think about this as a kind of a flow of steps that you want to do, obviously it all starts with good design and thinking about it. Now, like I said, I'm primarily a developer, so if I'm creating a new app, I'll break out Visual Studio, file a new project, and I probably write some code, because I tend to focus on solving the hard problem, the actual functionality, and then you kind of slap a UI on it as an afterthought. Now, that's not going to give a great user experience, so you need to actually have that design. If you're in a company where you actually have some UX designers, then that's actually, this is their key part to really contribute and come up with the good user experience, the good use cases, the interactions that you're going to have with your app. And once the design is refined, then we build it out. And we have a whole bunch of intelligent controls from Microsoft and from our partners that can really take a lot of the hard work away from you and give you a lot right out of the box to help you to create these great user experiences across different devices. And then you, as the developer and the designer, you need to think about this responsive UI. This is the same idea as web developers are used to in creating a UI that's going to scale as the screen size changes depending on the devices where it's running. So we have to use responsive UI techniques to make sure our app can adapt to different usage scenarios and different screen sizes. And then you might also want to think about tailoring for the platform, another factor about great user experience. And by that I mean thinking about how a user is primarily going to use your app. I mean, take an example of, you know, something like Outlook, the mail app, which Outlook, of course, is this big, it has your mail, it also has your calendar, it's this huge all-singing, all-dancing application. And when you use it on a desktop PC, you have a rich UI and lots of tabs, and you dive straight in, it's quite easy to navigate, but it's all there, and it's a very, very rich UI. Now, the same app, it is the same app running on a phone, well, actually, the usage scenario, you've got to tailor it to the screen size for sure. But you also want to think a little bit about, okay, how is the user actually going to interact with this app? What is their primary use case for this one? And actually, if you think about phone, it tends to be a little bit more snack and go kind of things. It's a user interactions where you want to glance at it and get your next few appointments or have a quick glance at new emails that have come in. You have a quick glance and then you put it away again. So there are different user interactions, different ways that the user is going to interact with it. So that feeds into the whole process as well about creating a great user experience. So let's look a little bit more about that first bit of that, the design process. And actually, you know, you want to sort of start thinking like a designer. What do I mean by that? Well, those of us, actually, how many of you here would call yourself a designer primarily? Okay, great. One person, yes. So I'm not going to put ideas into... for me, as a kind of primary developer, you want to start thinking like a designer, because as a team, you all need to work together. Now, designers, they're developers too, you know. They actually will often write code, and they will iterate their designs and test and try stuff out and do use cases and user testing, all these kind of things come into the design process. And, you know, the whole process is like quite often to brainstorm the ideas first. So, you know, you've got the user, the concept for the app, you need to brainstorm how those interactions are going to happen. You'll kind of play with some mood boards and concept designs. You will try out a few things and circulate it amongst your team and get feedback. And you're kind of working on the color scheme and the graphics, the layout, the kind of look and feel of the app. And all of this before any code has been written. And then you might sketch out the designs and do some wireframes and that sort of thing. So, and then, of course, you kind of feed that back into your design process, and that's an iterative thing. You go over that through that many, many times in order to come up with zero in on the actual design that you want for this application that your developers eventually are then going to build out.
Now, we have one designer in the room we've already established, so please keep us honest here for the rest of the talk. For the rest of us in the room, the developers in the room, how many of you still work with wireframes when you're developing an application? What? See, just a couple of hands go up. How many of you work with designers on your team who do wireframes? More hands. Okay, great. So you're familiar with the concept. Andy talked a few minutes ago about how producing a great user experience often means sweating the small details. It's better when you sweat them up front than when you sweat them at the end. The earlier that you figure out how you want the user experience to work, the better off the experience is going to be for the users, and frankly, the more on time, on target, and on budget your project will be. So wireframes, pretty simple concept. I think we all probably understand it, even if we don't work with them day to day. Wireframes are, they're pictures, they're blueprints, they're skeletons. They show what goes where. They help you lay out the pieces of the experience, and they enable you to have conversations with your stakeholders, whether they're users, whether it's the business stakeholder that represents the customer, and lets you get that feedback to make sure that everyone is, yes, this is what we're trying to build. This is the experience that we want to create. And if you look at what's on the screen right now, you'll see this is a screen from a smartphone application. We can tell that. Looks like it's, can't tell exactly what's going on here, but it looks like it's a logon screen. Maybe the user's being prompted to log on. Maybe they've just completed the logon. I can see there's a well done message. There's a check mark. Maybe the check mark is a reward for what they've just done. Maybe it's a button they're supposed to click to go on to the next thing. You can't exactly tell what's supposed to happen. And that kind of points out one of the limitations of working with these flat wireframes. So how many people here work with prototypes? Full-on prototyping. Okay, a few folks. So if you do work with prototyping, then you know the benefits that prototyping will bring over wireframes. Whereas wireframes are basically flat, two-dimensional pictures of the UI, prototypes are fully interactive, testable, and that's key, simulations of the actual application, of the user experience itself. There's no real code, at least there doesn't have to be. I suppose you could actually do the coding and build the app, but there are tools available that enable you to do it without any code. The key here is you're really focusing on the user experience itself. You want actual controls that work as close as possible to the real environment. You don't want just static screens. You want to be able to actually create states and wire up controls so that they produce the actual effect. They have the cause and effect that the actual applications will have. How many people actually create fully interactive prototypes using a prototyping tool rather than actually doing the code? Okay, almost no hands. In fact, I can't see any. So that's why I want to, are there a couple in the back? I am like blinded by the light right now. So what we want to recommend to you today to consider is do your prototyping up front rather than doing the coding and iterating as you go. Studies have shown repeatedly that teams that do full-on prototyping during the requirements gathering phase, during the envisioning phase, will save up to 40 to 50% of the effort they would otherwise have spent on avoidable rework. Now, none of us are going to get, well, maybe we will, but it's pretty rare that we get a delivery exactly to the user's expectations, the customer's expectations on that first build, right? Typically, there's some iteration, there's some conversation that goes on. But when you actually have something visual and almost tangible that you can look at and interact with before you sign off on business requirements and before you start coding, you're more likely to bring your project in on time and on budget. And the cost of fixing or correcting those problems is virtually free before you start coding. It increases by a factor of 10 once you're in design phase and by a factor of 100 once you've actually delivered that. So the best practice is to do your prototyping up front, test your prototype, not just put it in front of someone and get some verbal feedback, actually have them interact with that, iterate that, and do that as a separate cycle before you actually begin coding. Now, the company I work for, Infragistics, brings a tool to developers called Indigo Studio. You can go up to the URL on this slide and you can download a free trial of that today. Indigo Studio enables you to do rapid, code-free prototyping. We include controls for all different platforms. You can download, you can create your own. Once you create those prototypes, you can publish them into the cloud, send a URL to your users, get feedback, collect that feedback, evaluate it. And then what I think is the actual coolest feature is you can do remote, unmoderated usability testing at scale. So how many of you guys do usability testing in your environment? You will bring in users, you'll have designers or developers watch them interact. Yeah. So that's great to do when you do when you're testing out a major metaphor or paradigm design, but when you're doing small refinements, that gets really expensive, both in time and money, really quick. Indigo Studio lets you do that out of the box. I'm going to show you how that works. Andy, if you wouldn't mind switching me over to my demo machine.
Sure.
Anybody recognize this app? If you use your Windows desktop or if you still have a Windows phone, you probably do. This is the Windows app that's built into Windows. It is a UWP app. And here we kind of reverse engineered it into a prototype just to show you how close to the actual experience you can get by creating a prototype. This was created in Indigo Studio. Once it's published, it goes up into the cloud, hosted on our indigodesign.com server that's included when you buy a license for Indigo. You can then share the URL with any user, and then it becomes a fully interactive prototype. You don't need a special client. You don't need a special viewer. I can go ahead, I can change the day, look at the weather. Again, this is not the real app. These days have passed. I do not know if this was the actual weather at the time. There is no data in here. All I'm really trying to do is trying to mimic the experience so I can find out if my users actually think that this is an intuitive app to work with. And if I want to provide some feedback while testing the app, I can do that. I can go ahead and put some comments in here. I can say, well, I see Fahrenheit or Celsius, but it seems to me that I should be able to click on Celsius, and I can't. So I could say, Celsius Fahrenheit should be clickable. And I can enter that in, and it goes right into the cloud and associated with that prototype. Now here's a look at what that looks like in Indigo Studio itself. Here's the prototype. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through creating one from scratch, but you can see the controls I have over on the right. I can drag and I can drop and I configure them on the screen. I can select any of the ones that I've already brought onto the screen. And I can bring up a configuration dialog box. And I can go ahead and I can add or I can change an interaction. Again, these are full controls. So I can see what happens when someone hovers over it, taps, double taps, presses and holds, swipes. I can treat these just like real controls and wire that up. And then once I'm finished, I can share that prototype and it will get published on our server in indigodesign.com. Now switching back for just a minute to that, once I have them on indigodesign.com, I can go ahead and take a look at my prototypes. Here's that app I just created. And I mentioned the usability testing aspect of it. I'll show you how easy it is to do that. I can go ahead and say I want to create a usability study. I've only got three tabs I need to configure: welcome text, thank you text, which I can leave as the generic, and the actual task or tasks that I want to track. I'll say I want to add a new task, and I'd like to see if the user can display the weather for the following day. I'll record the task flow. It'll open up a tab. I'll say mark this as the starting point from the home screen. And I need to figure out how to display this. I'm going to go ahead and select the next day. I'm going to save that task flow. Now all I have to do is click start this study. It says it's waiting on study participants. I can click invite, get a URL, send this an email to a user or many users. If I'm one of those users, I can go ahead and click on the URL. This is the experience. I get welcome to the study. I'll start it. Here's my task that I just configured. I'll start the task. I'm going to look around, see if I can figure out what to do. I think I'll click there. Now that I've completed it, I can leave some feedback about how easy or difficult that was. Say I'm done. And that study is now completed. And if I go right back into my dashboard on indigodesign.com, you can see that I now have one user who's completed the study. It took about 9 seconds. I can see the details. If there's multiple steps, I can see where they got hung up or were successful. I can see the click map, and I can see where they were successful or where they failed. You can see I kind of hovered here and didn't quite know what was going on before I clicked in the right place. And all of this is available in Indigo Studio that, once again, you can download as a free preview, a free 30-day preview, trial rather, on infragistics.com. The URL is in the slide deck. So now that we've talked about ways to ensure that you have a great user experience up front, let's take a look at some of the various controls and tools that we bring to the table to help you do that.
Thanks, Ken. So, yeah, so we've been through that prototyping part of the whole process, and we now have kind of zeroing in, and we know what it is we want to build. So now it's obviously the developers have been working alongside the designers in trying to getting all that design drill down onto. So now it's kind of time to sort of really get into Visual Studio and start building this thing out. Now, we have a whole bunch of really great controls that you get out of the box with the Windows 10 UWP SDK. All the kind of really rich set of controls that are very capable. And these aren't just dumb controls. They actually have a lot of intelligence built into them. So this is the example here of a command bar. And you can see that actually when it's on a bigger screen, it will show more of those icons on it. It automatically will scale out and take advantage of the space that it's got. Whereas on the phone, of course, Well, the context menu will show some of the hidden items on the phone, but you don't have to code for these kind of things. You can influence it. There are properties. You can set which of the icons go onto the overflow menu, so you can prioritize, but it's built into the control to understand the environment where it is running and to do the right thing. And that extends also to input mode intelligence. You think of a classic thing like a drop-down list, a context menu, that sort of thing. So you can easily define one of those in your XAML or in code, and so the UI will show a context menu, a drop-down list. But it will know at the time when it displays how the user is interacting with your computer. Are they using a device that's basically in touch mode, like a tablet or a phone, in which case they are using touch? And if that's the case, then it will space the items out accordingly. So you have more space between them so that you have a good hit area that you don't have to do this kind of pointy fingernail thing where you're just trying to zoom in on a hit target that's too small. And the other thing, you see the red things there? This is obviously a list. You get navigation adorners. So this, if a user is using a mouse, then clearly they need to have a way of navigating up and down a list like this, so it will put those navigation adorners on it automatically for you. So you don't have to code for these scenarios. The intelligent controls will help you out with that. Whereas on the right, of course, we're back into touch mode, and you don't need those additional control surfaces. So great help from all of the controls. Some new stuff we brought in the latest release, the one that's just gone out with the anniversary update SDK. We've got some new features in the command bar to actually further customize the way that it handles overflow. So the dynamic overflow enabled you can actually disable the automatic one, and then you could have an event that fires and you can control things a little bit more closely. You can set the dynamic overflow order, which order they turn up onto the overflow menu if that's needed. And you can find out in code whether a command bar is in overflow state so that you can actually write a code accordingly according to the situation where you're in. You also have a lot of help from the controls according to the device family where we're running. So one of the big features with the anniversary update was you can now run UWP apps on additional devices. So HoloLens is now a first-class citizen. It was in preview before. And Xbox One is now a target for UWP apps, so you can write apps and run them on those devices as well. But you have to think about the way users interact with different devices. The Xbox, the 8-foot experience, 10-foot experience, is it? Yeah, across the living room. And it's a long way away, and things tend to be drawn bigger, and the way that you navigate is with a controller. You get very much more visual feedback from the screen than you would do for the same app running on a desktop or a tablet. So we actually have help from the system. By default, implicit built into these controls is these focus visuals. These are properties that we've added onto Framework Element, which is the base class for all of our controls. And by default, on an Xbox, you get the big red focus triangle around it. You get that for free. You can customize it, of course, but it will do the right thing for you out of the box. And then when it's running on a different system, you get the less obvious focus indicator around the controls. And all this is customizable, but the point here is that the controls will get you a long way down the road to where you want to be without you having to do very much. Yeah, you can change things like the focus box. You can change that to a dotted line. Everything is customizable, but the default behaviors will probably do what you want. Sound is another interesting one. Think of sound as part of a user experience. Again, if you're familiar with an Xbox, you'll know that as you navigate around different elements, you get the sound coming out. So we had to do a lot of engineering in the UWP controls in order for the right thing to happen when the app is running on an Xbox. And sound is crucially important. So we have this element sound player. And the default state for that is auto, which basically means sounds are on Xbox and off everywhere else. But you can override that. And that you get the right sounds by default, but you can actually play with the element sound player. You can play specific sounds at any time as well if you want to give a little bit of audio feedback to users. So again, this is kind of thinking out of the box about how users are going to interact with your device. We also brought out in the latest update some new APIs and features around context menus. This is where, you know, you right-click with a mouse on something and other additional options appear on a menu. Or you tap and hold if you're in touch mode. And this is a kind of a first class, a classical way for users to interact. People will offer, if they're not sure what to do with something, they'll right-click to see if some options come up. Now, that's always been possible to do in UWP apps, but we didn't actually have the way that users invoked a context menu wasn't defined. So actually, everybody kind of rolled their own solution for that. And some people would double-click, and somebody would write their app to mean tap and hold for a certain period of time. And it was kind of a little bit of anarchy going on there. So anyway, now, thankfully, we've added a new element, a new event onto a framework element, which is the context requested. So this behavior is now built right into all the controls, and the way that users invoke the context menu is standardized, and it's tap and hold on touch, and it's right-click with a mouse, and that's all handled for you. You don't have to write any code for that anymore. And then you get this nice context flyout we've added into the latest release, which is the way that you can easily define the options in a menu, because again, there was no consistency in how that would look to the user. So we've now added that into the control set. Another thing, again, thinking about the way that users interact with things. I'll come to you in a minute, Mesa. Yeah. Well, the way that you interact with applications, some people like keyboard shortcuts. No, developers love keyboard shortcuts. In Visual Studio, you're always doing Alt, Function, scratch behind your ear, press O, and you know, magic happens. But users like that as well, and we couldn't do that until the latest release. So now you can actually hit Alt, and you'll see shortcut menus come up, and the Alt and the O will open things, and all the kind of shortcuts that users have been familiar with in Windows apps for many years. And that's all available to you now. So you had a question? So yeah, would the PowerPoint be available? It is actually up on your MyIgnite. You can navigate to the session, and the PowerPoint is there for you to download, so you can get hold of that. Yeah. So that's the keyboard shortcuts. Now, this is another real nice innovation, which is beautiful in its simplicity. So here's the scenario, right? If you're an enterprise, you probably have some corporate color schemes. So it's a really good idea to actually brand your own apps, maybe for your internal apps to go to your workforce, or if you're doing a public-facing app, you need to want to have it branded with your identity. This is such a common requirement for people. Now, how do you do that? Well, the thing is, with the controls, like think of a button. Maybe you want to change the color, the background of the color. When you mouse over it, you want to have a particular color showing. That was one of those things you think, well, how hard can that be? You know, and actually it was one of those things that actually was quite a lot harder than it ought to have been. So the problem was this, and that each of the controls are defined as a big template of XAML. It's hidden to you. When you create some XAML, you just drag a button onto the canvas. It's this nice high-level object that you're working with. But underneath, a button is a whole template of XAML, and you can get a copy of that and customize how your button looks and what colors it uses and that sort of thing. Now, the difficulty in the past was if you wanted to change the pointer over color, well, you had to go into the definition of the template, and you'd find that it was defined as system base high color, which is a logical name for a highlighter color. The user can change that. But it's a system-wide color. So you go into your application, you change that color, system base high color, and then you find out that actually one of the other controls was using that color for something else. So you have these kind of unexpected consequences thing going on. So you take a whole copy of the template for the button, and then you customize the color right in it, and then you apply that to your button. But the problem with that is, and that works, but it's a lot of work to you. And the other problem with it is it, as we release updates to new versions of the SDK, we might fix some problems in the template. We update it. But of course, you don't get those updates because you've got a copy of the old template in your application. So this has been a long-standing irritation for folks. So now, in the anniversary update, we fixed that problem in a really nice and simple, elegant way. And all we have done is simply added another layer of indirection between the underlying system colors and the control colors that the particular control is using. So now we have a new logical color called button foreground pointer over, which maps by default to, of course, system base high color. So that's what you get. But if you want to change the point of color when you're over a button throughout your application, all you need to do is override button foreground pointer over at the application level, and that just applies throughout your application. Nice and simple, change that color, and you don't have these problems of having to customize the template, and you don't have this unintended consequences of accidentally changing colors on other controls. So a simple thing, it's nice, but it's a real nice value add for folks. Now, we've just touched on a few of those controls there. If you want to get the real, all the guidance about spacing, about how to use it, and all the kind of stuff like that, you need to go up to the URI there. It's on MSDN. It's the actual developer resources for UWP, and there's loads of information about all of the different controls and good advice and best practices on how to use them. We also have just released, literally a few weeks ago, an add-on to the out-of-the-box SDK set, which is some additional controls and a whole set of APIs around animations and things, which I'm going to come onto in a little while, and a few extra controls that fill in a few of the gaps that we saw in our control set. But we as Microsoft, we know we don't want to be the ones who try and do everything, because we have a lot of very, very valuable partners who also create superb controls that supplement and in some places replace some of our standard ones and give additional behaviors. And of course, one of those companies is Infragistics.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, Infragistics, if you're familiar with us, you probably know that for 25 years or more, we've actually been producing great controls to help you make incredible user experiences on top of the Windows platform. We have today a free preview of a set of UWP controls that are available for you to check out. Now, Andy just spent the last several minutes showing us all of the cool controls that are available to you that help bring out the elegance and the beauty and the sophistication of the UWP experience. But at some point, you want to create an experience that is in service of some purpose that the user is trying to accomplish. You may, in short, want to bring some information to life. And that's where at Infragistics we focus. Our controls that we have available for UWP today really enable you to bring information to life, whether it's text information, whether it's data. And in fact, if you can switch me over to the demo machine, Andy, we can take a look at that. If you go up to our website today, you'll be able to download our preview controls. Now, by the way, we call these preview, but they are, in fact, ready to go, and you can start building on them and incorporating them into your apps. They're called preview because it's just a limited set of controls right now while we finish building out the rest of them. We wanted to bring them to market right away and start getting feedback from our developers. I couldn't hear the question. Could you? The controls what combined? 508 compliant. I do not know. I will have to look that up for you after the session. If you come on up, I will find that out for you. Thanks. So if you download our controls, it includes a sample browser, and you can see the controls that we bring to you today. It includes a data grid that will let you manipulate information in tabular format, and you can sort, you can live update. We have our award-winning data chart control that many of you have probably used on other platforms. And because this is the standard UWP experience, I can zoom in, I can pan, I can resize. I can start doing live updates. Our product manager at Infragistics calls this the Chuck Norris of chart controls. You can do almost anything with it. There's all sorts of different views, all sorts of different features that you can do, and I encourage you to check it out and look at it. We also have other controls that let you do things like radio gauges, barcodes, QR codes. It's all here, and you can check them out today, and it's here to help supplement the great controls that we already have in the UWP community and help you build great applications. Andy?
Thanks, Ken. Thanks. All right, so that's been a lot of information. I want to sort of change tack a little bit, and we're going to move into more of the implementation stuff, and we're going to look a little bit more about that responsive UI that I talked about and actually how you do that in an application. and we're going to drill into a specific example. So this is the beauty of UWP, is that you can have the same universal app tailored for lots of different devices. This is actually our media player app, and you can see that it runs just great across a huge range of devices, right from a small phone right on the left there, through tablets, through desktops, even and up onto the Surface Hub, the huge screen thing, the wall-mounted device that we have for group collaboration. And then, of course, in the living room, on the Xbox, you can have it running there, and even running on the HoloLens. And in each case, you're getting a UI that is scaled appropriately to that device, and is also customized to give a great, is responding to the screen size where it is running to give a great user experience. So how do you actually do that? How do you actually implement something that has that flexibility? Well, first of all, you start with the universal controls. We talked about those, the controls and the way you can style them. You can change the colors and you can make that all work out great. And you position them, lay them out on your views. And then we also have included in there is not only the obvious visual controls like the buttons and the beautiful data grids and all these kind of things, but we also have a bunch of layout panels which allow you to do clever stuff like, as the screen size gets narrower, I want you to move that block of content from the right and stick it out underneath here. So your relative positioning of content, moving things around, reorganizing the layout of stuff on the screen. We have some great panels that allow you to do all that repositioning, and you can trigger the layout changes based on the screen width. We also have this effective pixels. So this is the thing, if you think about how a UWP app might be used, if you use a phone, you tend to hold it right in front of your face. Tablet's a little bit further away, and the desktop's further away again. And then you get to the Xbox is 10 feet away. So you've got all of these different viewing distances. And of course, as you know, objects that are further away appear smaller. So how do you kind of handle that situation where your one app is going to run across a range of these different screens and different viewing distances? Well, the good news there is you effectively don't have to, because we work to, as designers, we lay out our pages according to using a logical pixel size. So we're not working with physical pixels, we're working with effective pixels, which is a logical pixel size. And essentially, the system will automatically scale things according to the device where it's running. So you can just design something on the screen in Visual Studio that looks good on the screen there while you're working it. And then when it runs on a phone, it will look okay. When it runs on an Xbox, it will look okay. It will look appropriately sized. So you don't have to create absolutely unique UI for each of those devices. You can have one UI that is responsive and adapts, and you get a lot of help from the system in doing that. And the scaling system is one of those things that helps. And then that's not in itself enough. So you also want to think about, well, phone screen is portrait, and it's not a case of shrinking everything down so you can see exactly the same. And also coming back to that point I made earlier about think about the user experience and how the user is going to interact with it on a particular device. But you're going to then need to do some work as the developer to create a UI that adapts to different screen widths. And we use these techniques, adaptive layout techniques, which are essentially the same thing that web designers do, web developers do, to create a web page that will also adapt according to the screen size of the device where it's being viewed. It's the same deal, but it applies just the same to native apps that you write in UWP as it does to web pages. And we have custom triggers that we can fire based on the screen width, which will adjust layout. It might hide some content and show other bits of content. And these triggers are triggered usually on the screen width, but you can actually trigger on any environmental characteristic, like the device type or other things that you code up. And you tend to define key screen breakpoints. So you say, okay, I want my app to be used by people on phone primarily, and on tablet, and on like laptops. So those are my key ones. So you'll pick those kind of key sizes as your target, your main development targets. You make sure it works brilliant on those. You might do some user testing on some intermediate ones, but generally, if you code for the breakpoints, the other ones will just kind of come out in the wash, and it will all work out just fine. And in all of this, we have great help from Visual Studio and Blend. You can simulate in the tools. You can look. There's a drop-down list where you get the phone and the different phone, 5-inch phone, 6-inch phone, 8-inch tablet, 12-inch tablet, all the way through all the different devices, even including things like IoT devices, are all in that list so you can visualize right in the tools what it's going to look like on each of those different screens. Just to drill down a little bit more on those breakpoints, you know, again, like thinking about the phone, it tends to be, this is the effective pixel sizing. Yeah, a phone screen tends to be 360 by 640 effective pixels. And the when you get to a tablet, we're talking about 1024 by 640. And you can see as it's scaling up there across the different range of devices. So sure, the screens are bigger, but you're working to one logical screen sizing. And the system's taking care of scaling things according to the viewing distance. So pick the ones that you want to design for. So maybe, okay, I'm going to go for the phone, I'm going to go for the big tablet, and I'm going to go for the Xbox. And then you design each of those and test them thoroughly, and then the other ones should work out. Now, to put this into a real classical example, I'm actually going to look at a sample that we created for Build, our Build conference in San Francisco, which happened back in March. And I was running a UWP code lab there, and we built this sample, and I worked with our design team to come up with something that encapsulated great design practices. And it's all up on GitHub, so developers who want to have a go at this, there's Code Labs UWP, and there's step-by-step instructions or exercises of building out a responsive UI. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a taste of it now. Now, this particular app, it uses two main controls. It has a thing called a split view, which is the sometimes erroneously called the hamburger control. It has a little hamburger at the top, and you have a navigation column that comes out that allows you to navigate around the app. And then we have the content area. And we're also using a map view on there. It has a lot of other stuff as well we don't have time to go into, like inking and great features like that. But I'm going to now do a quick demo to show you exactly how we handle that responsive UI side of things. All right, so this, I'm in Visual Studio now. Like I said, you get help from this. I mean, I'm working on a kind of compressed resolution here, so this is kind of small. When I'm working on a full-size screen, it's a little bit more useful, but you can choose here and have a look at what my UI is going to look like on an 8-inch tablet. Is it going to trigger for me? Come on. There we go. And so you can try this out and visualize it. But mostly I'm going to be working, and you can work in the design surface, but at this resolution I'm going to work mainly in the XAML. So the XAML, if you're not familiar with this is what actually defines all the stuff you can see visualized up there. I'm going to run it first, and we can see how it's this version of the app, where we've got to with this thing. And it's what this application was. It's called Sites to See, and the idea is that you are going on a visit to some place for business or vacation, and this app is there to suggest some key sightseeing destinations you might want to go and view. So it gives you a curated list of interests, and you can choose which ones you want, and then they stick them up onto the screen and select them, and then you can plan your sightseeing things. So here we are, we're in the application, we've got a nice map control there, and it works pretty well as a full screen resolution like this. And you can see there's our the split view menu on the left, and here we've got different sites, so I can choose to go and see what, you know, if the Golden Gate Bridge, I can go and have a look at that. Let's just shrink this down a little bit. But what happens when I resize this? As you see, the user, and this here's the thing about UWP, is that the user can resize the window and obviously make it as big or as small as they like. But this app at the moment is not very responsive. The map is trying to sort of take over, and this is all chaos here. This is, like, terrible. And you can see we clearly have some work to do here. All right, so the way that you can fix this is by using these adaptive triggers that I mentioned to you. So let's just go in and fix this little problem here. So the way this application is defined, a split view, you have the menu bit, which is actually in a file called appshell.xaml. And in here, this defines the menu bit of that, the left-hand side. And we've got our we've got a down here, our split view control, here it is. And it has a pane, which is the navigation area, and then to the right of that has something called the content area, which is where you saw all the map and everything else, all the content. So what we're going to do here is use our visual state triggers. So visual states are things, is a new layout that gets applied according to some kind of a triggering of some kind. And we are, the default is to trigger an adaptive trigger based on the window width. Now at the moment I've just got one that is a kind of catch-all that's going to trigger according to any size, so zero means that. But actually this is going to be my wide state, so I'm just going to change that. So it's only going to trigger where my window width is 1024 effective pixels or more. And what we're doing here, we are simply setting properties of our split view control. Its name is the root split view. And a split view has a display mode, which dictates how the menu area relates to the content area. So at the moment, we are having a compact menu, which is and we are in line with the content, which means it sits alongside it. And the navigation pane is open, is true. But what happens when we get to be a little bit narrower than that? So I'm just going to insert a snippet here to add some different ones, which is going to trigger instead on 720 effective pixels or more until we get to 1024, and then the bigger one will take over. And this one is slightly different. So this one has the same properties, but we are setting different values on those properties. So instead of compact in line, it's compact overlay, which means the menu bit, when it's out, overlays the content area. So it kind of ends up compressing things nicely. And the navigation pane in this mode is actually closed. And then finally, we've got, well, it's probably erroneously called mobile state. This is actually the narrow screen state. It's called mobile state here just because it actually tends to be the one that you use on a phone as well. So the narrow window width on the desktop is the same pretty much as what you would view on a phone. And this one is the catch-all, it's the min width, it's a zero. And in this case, the display mode changes yet again to something called overlay, and the pane is still closed. So let's have a quick look at what those changes have done for us. So we're rebuilding, and I'm going to put this modified version up. And this will launch in just a second, and then we'll see how we've done so far. So here we go, we're launching out, and now we can try resizing the window and see what happens. Now remember, I've only changed the split view, so it's effectively just going to be the menu bit we've changed, so the content area still needs fixing. But now, when we get to 720, it compresses, and then when we get down to even less, then it's completely broken, in fact. Yeah, so that wasn't quite what I expected, actually. I must have done something a little bit wrong here. Let's have a quick look. It's mobile state 0, 720, 1024. It should be okay. All right. I'm going to put the other ones in. So I think the other bit is the content area. That's in a different file, which is the trip detail page. And we've got a similar pattern in there. This is much more complex. This is the content area with the map and everything. There's quite a lot of XAML. Looks a bit scary if you're not used to it, but actually this tends to kind of just, you end up building this out. Now here's my visual states. So I've got a desktop state there, and I'm going to add in the kind of middle-sized one. And I'm also going to add in the narrow screen one. And this time, we've got a whole bunch of properties we're setting because the content on this page is quite a lot more. There's a lot more going on there. We've got a map, we've got a grid of images, which is the sites, and we've also got a bunch of headers. So let's try this one now and see how we're doing with our layout. And this should be getting closer to the required output. And this is kind of the classical way of working on this, iterating on the layout and getting things to work out. So this is looking better now. So now we've got our widescreen one, we've got our mid-sized one for tablets, and then when we get into the phone one, then we've got our nice little layout. Now, another thing I want to just point out to you is if you, this, by the way, is these are debugging tools, so we can get rid of them. There we go. So the other thing is look at the header there. So we've also done some of those properties we're changing. We've actually got two different headers on it. So this, again, is creating a good, this is good design. Your designer will have come up and said, hey, you know what? When it's wide out like this, I want to have a big, bold header on it. But as we get compressed, I don't want to waste all of that space up there. We want to start making things a little bit more compact. So actually, the color changes as well. There was a bit of a branding thing going on. We have a smaller logo. But, you know, that's we're actually switching between two different headers there, which is quite nice. We can do even more than this as well. So if I now go off to one of the sites, you can see here. Now, over here, this is where you, this is a command bar up here, which is at the top. And this is where you can actually enter some notes. And this is also responsive, so it nicely resizes. And it is built, we did this before, so that's all kind of nice. But up here, we've got a command bar. And this says delete from trip. I've actually got a layout problem there. But you have to click that to see the icon, the actual text associated with that. And it's kind of a dustbin icon. So we can actually improve things here in order to make this a bit more usable. And one of the nice things we can do with that is there's a new property in the anniversary update which allows us to change this sort of thing. So we need the site detail page. And I need to go find that title command bar, which is difficult at this resolution, I can tell you. Title command bar. So this is a command bar. And there's a new property you can add on to this, which is the position of the layout. So I'm going to just type default label position. Default label position is bottom, collapsed, or right. And if I change that to right, this will have a nice effect, which for this version of the command bar, which is the expanded one you see, run that up. And we're immediately, this is a kind of user testing has shown that if you've got the screen real estate, it's better to show the hint about a button next to it. If you've got the space, you know, make this is all about good usability. So this will come up now, and we'll go into a particular site to Alcatraz. And now you can see we've got Add to Trip up there. So add to, it's now we're actually seeing it right next to the button. And as we compress down to the other version of the title bar, we're back to the default one where it's just a plus. So there's a nice usability thing that we've added to make things better. Now the other thing, let's run this on a phone. So I've got a phone here. So we'll stop that guy. Let's run the same thing on a phone. Start this guy up, allow screen projection. Here we go. Now, I'm going to switch to, when I get Visual Studio back and talking to me again. Come on. Visual Studio has just frozen on me. Go away. Right. That's not helpful. All right, well, I was going to deploy it from Visual Studio, but actually this app is already on here. So let's just run it and show you something on here. So here's the application. I'm going to run the same application on here. And we get the narrow layout by default on the phone, so that's real nice. And this is kind of a nice, you've got a scroll bar there, and we've still got the map, and that's real nice. And I can go into one of my sites. And notice here the actual command bar has gone down to the bottom of the screen. Now this is for it was up at the top before on the for the desktop and tablet usage, but phones tend to be one-handed use, so you want to put your command bars down at the bottom of the screen for the layout for the phone. Now you can do that with adaptive triggers. Or you can use another technique. And the technique that I did for using this, let's see if Visual Studio has come back to us. It has. There you go. So you could actually do, this is an interesting technique you can think of, is if you want to create a specific layout for a class of device, a device family, we have a control in the control set. I'm going to add a new item. And we have in XAML, we have something called a XAML view here. A XAML view is an interesting thing. It's not the same as a blank page. A blank page is what you'd normally use, and a blank page is XAML and C# or VB code behind. It's a combination of the two, and they work together. But a XAML view is just XAML. It doesn't have any code behind. And I'm not going to add a new one, because I've actually got here in the background, I've got one to add. So I'm going to include this into the project. This is one I did earlier. Now, what this is you see the name of it there. It's a site detail page.devicefamily-mobile.xaml, which is, and so this one is a custom version of the same site detail page. It shares the code behind, so I have exactly the same C# code, but the UI bit, the XAML bit of it, is only going to apply when you're running on device family mobile, which means phones. And we have other device families, device family Xbox, device family, I forget what the one is for the Surface Hub. It's not Surface, it's something else. We have all these different device families, so you can create custom views for specific device families. But don't feel that that's the, I mean, I'm just throwing that in there as a possibility. You do have to be a wee bit careful in doing custom views. Now, the reason why, I shall illustrate why. So let's come out of this. And I'm going to just connect this phone to a big screen. So one of the things you can do with these smartphones these days, the smart devices, you can connect to a wireless display for a big screen. Or I could connect to Steve's Surface. That would surprise him. I want to just finish this talk by looking at some of the new, really exciting new stuff we've got in the composition APIs, which are some brand new ways of really doing these really top-class animations. It's been, we've been hearing for a while that actually you can do simple animations in XAML, but they're a bit limited, and they don't really scale very well. So you can do some stuff like fade stuff and move stuff around, but a really rich, beautiful UI needs more than that. Now, what is beautiful? I mean, what beautiful is a subjective thing, of course, but you look at the way this animation's moving around the screen there. Lovely, smooth resizing. And we move it around, and then it shrinks nicely, and it's not like jumpy or anything. Beautiful, buttery smooth, as the cliche here, buttery smooth animations. And that's real nice animations. And these are this is what modern apps should aspire to. And we can now do this sort of thing relatively easily using the composition APIs. And we're investing a huge amount of effort in making this. We're building it right into the platform. So when you go from the start menu, you get lovely animations from there. And right into the platform, all our first-party apps are taking advantage of all of this stuff. So that's real nice and real beautiful things. Now, we've built this into the Windows UI platform right from the ground up. So if you think about how the UI framework is built up, you can think of it as a series of layers. So at the bottom, we've got the real kind of graphics layer. It's right down in the hardware where we're painting the pixels right onto the screen. This is the real low-level stuff. And then at the top, we've got the framework layer, which is where you're working with frameworks such as XAML, where we kind of work with high-level abstractions, and this is how you paint and build up your UI, all the adaptive UI we're looking at. Now, what we have added now is this new layer in the middle called the visual layer. So every item that is on the screen, that your app is painting onto the screen, has what we call a visual. And the visual is something that you can animate very nicely. It's the kind of visual representation of it. And with these new APIs, you can manipulate very easily the visuals on the screen to make it look really good. So, and in order to put those into terms, obviously the top one is windows.ui.xaml namespace. The bottom one is DirectX, so you only go down there if you're like a games middleware developer or you're a C++ developer, and you're right down there in the weeds with that. But the new one in the middle, the visual layer, is windows.ui.composition, these new APIs. So, and in terms of, what it means to program things, it's the classical thing that at the top, things are really quite easy to do. Very simple in XAML, or a few lines of code. And if down at the DirectX layer, anything is possible, but you need to be a bit of a whiz kid. And so what we're doing with visual layers, we're kind of trying to hit that spot in the middle. You might have to write a little bit more code, but it gives you more control, and you can do some really exciting things. And what this is all about is really making this an optimized performance engine and really getting beautiful animations. You can target thousands of visuals, and the point here is that everything runs on the GPU, the built-in graphics processing unit, so you're not impacting your main CPU, you're not impacting the interactiveness, the responsiveness of your app. You can get beautiful visuals, and you can also scale it up so your page could have thousands of visuals, and it still works, and you don't hit any performance cliff drop-offs, It's linear scalability, and you get great, great perf out of it. What it consists of is these content visuals, these sprite visuals, which are these objects that represent everything that's on the screen. And you can add these content visuals to the XAML UI tree, so you can work within the XAML system with these things. We have a whole animation system, keyframe animations, which are things that act over a period of time. And we also have something new called expression animations, which is interesting, where an animation on one element can be related to what's happening on a different element through an expression. So you can actually chain things together. And we have a great effect system for doing like color effects, contrast, exposure, grayscale, and that kind of thing, applying effects to images. This was the first release of stuff that was actually in the November 2015 release. But now with the Windows 10 Anniversary SDK, we've expanded it again much more. We've got improved XAML interoperability. We've got some new animations, including connected animations, which is particularly exciting. And we have some great new effects system. Blur, which has been a long-standing ask for people, how can we do blur? That was a thing that was really difficult. We can do that easily now, drop shadow and lighting effect. So it's really, really exciting. Now, you do have to write quite a lot of code for most of these things, but again, the UWP Community Toolkit I mentioned does have some helper classes that make some of the simpler effects really, really easy. And there is an app that you can download from the store which shows you the XAML and the C# code you'd need to use some of their things for fading, scaling, and blurring things simply. But, Ken's worked his magic. So here we go. So we'll circle back. Remember the continuum thing? So, yoo-hoo! This is my, here we go. This is my, we're now running off the phone. And you get a start screen. And then, you know, if you've got a, best thing is actually to have a Bluetooth mouse paired up with your phone. But you can actually use a touchpad on the screen here. So you can actually kind of go in and get to the apps menu. I can tap on that. And there's our application up there. So I can now launch my sites to see on the big screen. And this is running on the phone, but it is the same app. Well, here we are. We now have got, obviously, we've got the widescreen layout because it's aware of the width of the screen. But this is running, this is actually the device family mobile version. So this is the point about, A, the flexibility of UWP and the way that different devices can adapt to work to different kind of user input modes. It's the same with a Surface Book. You know, I can rip the screen off the keyboard, and it works just as a tablet. Switch between desktop and keyboard mode and tablet and touch mode. But this is the same exact same app. And you can see, you know, it's beautiful, and we get all the same functionality that you get in the full scale running on a desktop. But this is running on a phone.
What are you seeing on the phone?
Well, I've just got a touchpad, which you can see is just a gray. It's just like a touchpad on a desktop at the moment. Yeah, yeah. Great. So I'm glad. Thank you for that. We've got persevered on that. All right. So now then. Back to my system, and I want to just show you a few quick demos that will illustrate some of the power of the composition. So let's go over here. So now this, if you go up onto GitHub, you can get all of the composition API samples that are up there, and you can download this code. So I'm just going to run their sample app so that you can see the Windows UI Dev Labs. And see the power of the composition APIs. So this is an application that can sample. You can actually try out some of these things. Here's a nice animation which I'm just touching on the screen. You can swipe things, and I could click the toggle button. You can see the same effect. Let's have a look at some of the other ones. Let's see, which one shall we do? Foreground focus effect. So here's an example that when you select an item, the background you can actually blur the background and bring something up to the foreground. So that's a foreground focus effect. So something is laying over it and you get that blur. You can change the background to a rainbow blur. That's not so good. Well, as you can see the power of it. I'm not saying necessarily you're going to find a use for all of these, but layer visuals. So, you know, this is like as we mouse over, it's kind of coming out. You get this 3D, so coming out of the screen. And it's beautiful. And these are really actually, and all the code is there for you to copy and to incorporate into your own applications. Let's have a look at the connected animation. This is a real nice one. So here we have got a grid view. And the idea is this is the classical one where you have a grid of items and the user selects something and then you navigate to a different page. The whole master detail thing, where you get to the detail page and show more of the item. Well, that kind of, by default, if you're a beginner XAML application developer, it's easy to create a navigation from one page to another, but not so easy to get a nice animation across the two. Well, you couldn't do it until recently. But now, look, I'm going to select one of the ones in the middle here, and it animates, it comes out at the page and animates into position, and then as we go back, it goes back into position. And that actually, the sample for that is relatively easy to implement, that sort of thing. It just gives a nice continuity across one page to the other.
Just to be clear, those are actually two pages.
So that's true. The question is that two pages? That is exactly two pages, yes. And actually, I've applied this example, I have applied to the Sites to See app, and I'll show you that in a minute, and it'll become a new version of the Sites to See app, which I built this morning, funnily enough, because I thought, well, let's do this on the Sites to See app. The last one I want to show you is Interactions 3D. So here, an iteration tracker, I'm actually going to navigate. You've got lots of depth there. You can see it's got loads of images. Just see the power of that. And it's beautiful and buttery smooth. We're projecting, so it's a little bit. If you're not projecting, it really is super smooth. It's a little bit jumpy like that. That's an example. Oh yeah, and actually, if you just leave it, it animates on its own. So that's real nice. And all of these effects, there's a whole catalog of stuff in there that you can actually have a look at. Zoom with perspective. That's can't imagine ever using that one. But there you go. So really rich graphical effects that you can do. Now I mentioned that I actually have built this into the Sites to See thing. So let's go off and. Let me go and find that one. So, not that guy. Here we go, the connected animations version. So this is one I just did a new version of the Sites to See this morning, just to try and build in that connected animation. So let's start, load this into Visual Studio. A lot of those were real rich samples, but you don't have to, you can pick and choose some of them just to give a gloss of quality to your applications, and they're not actually too hard to do. Now, this one, I did this, just quick show you some of the code. So I'm navigating from the trip detail page to the site detail page, so going from the master view, going over to the other one, and this is the code I had to plug in, and I just simply copied it from the sample app. So we have a compositor here. We get a compositor, and we are, let's see, that's all standard code. It's down the bottom here is the stuff I added in. Here we are. This is in the new composition API. It's called the Connected Animation Service for building these things. So you have to get some references to the items that you want to animate. You prepare to animate the particular item. You apply a couple of transitions to it, and then that's kind of pretty much all you have to do. And then this is where you also animate kind of coming back again. There's a little bit of, so that you can see it's a little bit more code than a XAML animation, but real the effect is really great. So now let's have a look at what that. And it took me about half an hour to plug this in this morning into this application. Run this version up, and. You can see the effect. Here we go. So now I'm going to animate from Alcatraz. Well, no, let's go down to Chinatown here. I'm going to animate out to the detail page. And we see it leapt out from its position, and we got that connected animation going across the two pages. So that was relatively easy to add that. And it's just that little bit of extra nice gloss that are going to make, you're going to end up with better user satisfaction because you've sweated the little details and put a little bit of effort into giving a real nice, great user experience. So we're about out of time. There's plenty more we could talk about. So at this point, just to say thank you very, very much for coming to this session. We'll take any questions now, but could we also encourage you to please evaluate the session. It's really helpful to us to get your feedback and let us know what you liked and how we could do better, and that would be really great.
If I could start with the gentleman who, I can't see you, but hopefully you're still there, who asked about the 508 compliance for the infragistics controls a little earlier. They are not 508 compliant in preview form. I do expect them to be for the commercial release. You're right. So the gentleman is saying that it's a really important aspect of good UX design, and shame on us for not addressing that, is making sure that your experience is fully accessible so that people who have disabilities can still get the full experience out of it. And
yep.
That is something that we should have addressed.
Yeah, that's right. And I mentioned that for the Microsoft controls and our own applications, there's a huge focus within Microsoft to make sure that accessibility is top of everybody's mind. So the controls are built to help you to build those things, and then the hooks are there for you help you to create those accessible experiences. Do we have any other questions? Yeah.
So the question, if I heard it right, is can you integrate Indigo with Visual Studio? There's no actual handshake, so it's not going to spit out code or anything that you can import into Visual Studio. You can export CSS and HTML, but ultimately it's really designed to be a prototyping tool that you would then use to have your designers go and create the visual assets out of, and then your developers would code behind. I will say that over time we are working to extend that experience into more of a full development tool, but in this current release, it is indeed just a prototyping tool.
Yep.
Yes, I think that is indeed the vision.
So yeah, the question is, with the adaptive triggers, do they need to be ascending? You can position them anywhere to get. They need to be in a visual state group, but it doesn't. The order in which you declare them within the page is not significant. It's the actual number that it triggers on that's the significant thing. And you can have additional visual state groups that are triggered on other things like device family, or you can write a little class, a custom trigger. So it's completely, you can trigger on just whatever you want to trigger and apply different property values to your controls according to some kind of other factor. So, no, the order isn't significant. The adaptive triggers, though, are based on the min window, the window width, and the alternative is window height. Those are the only two that are built right into the triggers. Other ones are you'd have to use custom triggers. There's also a bunch of MVPs have created a whole family of these things. So there's pretty much, if you think of a custom trigger you might want, it's probably already been written. So go look for that. So yes, the question, you assume this is, is this the adaptive triggers only UWP?
As well as the visual layer,
then? Well, interestingly, the visual layer, the animation composition is intended to, I'm not sure what the status is, but they are definitely working to expose some of that in WPF as well. It's a Windows 10 entity, if you like, so it would need to be those apps running on there. So I have to find out the exact details of how much is available, but it's certainly intended to be available, not just in UWP. Question there. So the question is UWP apps running in HoloLens. So actually, yeah, weirdly, perhaps 2D apps built for a screen will run just great in HoloLens. What you actually get is a floating window appears in front of your eyes. You can then do cute stuff like pin it to the wall and all this kind of thing, and move it around in your scale, your vision, your viewing. You can move it around, you can resize it, and that sort of thing. Essentially, you just end up with a 2D window that you can position, but the app will run just fine on that. In order to get the best out of HoloLens, the 3D animated, you know, overlays, the augmented reality thing, UWP apps will work on there, but that's not making the best of the HoloLens. For that, you need to use basically the gaming technology to create those animations. So yeah, the question is, are these features going to make their way into Xamarin Forms? And you're right to say, obviously, since Microsoft acquired Xamarin, we have teams are working very closely to try and bring the technologies closer. And we are sort of working on that. I actually don't know what plans they might have in Xamarin Forms for sort of adaptive triggers or anything. So if you would leave me your card, I'll find out what their plans are and what I can share on that one. But I actually don't know off the top of my head. Yeah.
Similar to the other WPF question, are the intermediate brush overrides
going to
be making their way there?
Are the intermediate brush overrides? Oh, the control, yeah, the control colors. I actually don't know the answer to that for WPF controls. I'm afraid not. I don't know. All right, I think we're about done. We'll still be here if anybody wants to come and chat to us, but just thanks very much for coming and enjoy the rest of Ignite. Thank you.
Thank you.